people asking if I was later an Isser or Isser of going to Egypt. What is the Isser?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. There is a pasuk that says, when we left Mitzrayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, the way you have seen the Egyptians today, you will never see them forever. Now that could have many, many meanings, but the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah codifies this as a commandment that it is forbidden for the Jews to live in the land of Egypt. Now, that's an extremely perplexing comment for the Rambam to make, because the Rambam wrote it in Egypt. The Rambam was living in Cairo when he wrote it. So now they say, there's a letter from the Rambam in which he signed his name, and it says, Moshe ben Maimon, the one who transgresses a prohibition of the Torah every day. However, it's clear that that was a forgery. The Rambam did not write that, etc. So that's one question to keep in mind, right? How could, if the Rambam says it's usher, how could he live in Egypt? The other is, we just had the Levaya of the great Rav Ovadia, and although Rav Ovadia was born in Eretz Yisrael, he was born in Iraq, but he came to Eretz Yisrael as a four-year-old, it's less known that he actually spent 2 years in Cairo as the so-called chief rabbi of Egypt. He built a yeshiva there, he was quite involved, so obviously he held it was mutter. So the short answer that's given, the simplest answer that's given is that the prohibition of Mitzrayim does not refer to the land, it refers to living in the nation which is occupied by the ancient Egyptians that enslaved us. And it's absolutely clear, and this is, every historian will tell you this, that the modern day Egyptians are an Arabic people. They are descended from Ishmael. They are not even biologically related to the so-called ancient Egyptians. So as a result, we paskin, there's no prohibition of living in the land because you no longer have the nation that enslaved us. Now, there's a second argument that even if you took a strict position, it would not apply to passing through. The prohibition is to establish residence in Mitzrayim. It was not passing through. But as I say, Bizman Azed is even permitted to live in Egypt, assuming you're allowed to leave the land of Israel, which is the same thing. But living in Egypt would be halachically no worse than living in the United States. Although, as they say, I would prefer to live in America than Egypt. Now, let me say, just Derech Agav, having nothing to do with your question, but it reminds me of an association. I don't know if you ever heard this. There is a bit of a discussion that it's forbidden for a Jew to live in Spain. Have you ever heard that? It goes back to the idea, this was not written down anywhere, but there was like an oral Messiah among many Jews that when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492 on Tisha B'Av, they took a solemn oath, as it were, that no Jew would ever set foot back in Spain. And the poskim do discuss whether this is something that happened. Even if it did happen, how could those people impose an oath on everybody else? I mean, at most it might be a family oath or whatever it is. But Lamaisa, the minog there also is to be makel. Chabad, of course, has Chabad houses in Spain, and also many Jews live in Spain. Well, not many, but there are kahilos in Spain. And, of course, Spain has quite... It's interesting to know how the goyim that persecute us try to capitalize. You know, Poland now, I mean, some people are very much against this, you know, trips to Poland by yeshivas, by seminaries, are very, very common to visit the concentration camps and also to visit the graves of the great, great Gedolim that are buried in Poland. You know, 70 years ago, the Poles were very, very willing cooperators with the Germans in eradicating the Jews, and in fact they did it with more enthusiasm than the Germans. Now they make a lot of money out of the Holocaust. Spain too. Spain kicked us out in 1492, but when it comes to celebrating the 850th anniversary of the Rambam's death, Spain was very interested in making a big deal, attracting a lot of money, etc. But as I say, there's a similar question about Spain, and there too where we are making. Yeah.
What's the extent of our obligation to enlighten the other nations? And that's tied in with asking about Rabbi Sacks, because I'm sure that many would agree he's a second to none when it comes to articulating Judaism to the non-Jewish world.
Yeah.
But he's not exactly the most popular figure.
Well, Rabbi Sacks is he truly does very, very good and significant work in fulfilling that role. Rabbi Sacks was the former chief rabbi. Yuri is the former chief rabbi of England, and he is really probably the non-Jewish world's favorite Orthodox rabbi, etc., and really one of the non-Jewish world's famous rabbis all in all. Margaret Thatcher certainly liked him a lot more than the Archbishop of Canterbury, which were his, etc., because she felt that Rabbi Sacks had a much stronger set of moral values than the modernistic Church of England. I would say this. Absolutely, the Jew does have a mission to be an inspiration to the world, not by proselytizing, right? Our job is not to make people Jewish, but by teaching morality. This is what Hashem said about Abraham. Abraham is blessed because he spreads. He is a father to all of the nations of the world. Now, the reason why we do less of it, so to speak, is really the idea, it's really kind of a commonsensical idea, and that is, if we have limited time, limited energy, limited resources, and our own people, 90% of our own people, do not keep the Torah, do not keep the mitzvahs, so we got to work on our own first, you know, and we got to put our energies in building up the Jewish people. Now, it's true, if we ever reach the hypothetical point, which before Mashiach we probably are not going to reach, in which every Jew is a firm, you know, righteous person, then indeed, we then have a next step to do. Now, even now, however, even though we don't necessarily write books and articles, so to speak, to communicate to the outside world, but at least in a small degree, we are obligated to be a light unto the world in terms of Kiddush Hashem, in terms of our honesty, in terms of our Derech Eretz. And indeed, if we're not behaving appropriately and we're creating desecrations of God's name, we are transgressing the specific Yisr of Chilul Hashem, which is a specific, very Chomer Aveira. And in addition, we are betraying the fundamental mission of Or LaGoyim. So like anything else, you know, there are many, many things Hashem wants us to do in the world. Many, many things. And any one of us can only do a fraction of those things. And we have to pick and choose where our energies are best there. Now, Rabbi Sacks has a particular talent in that direction. And therefore, it's very good that he's doing what he's doing. I do applaud it, but it's not necessarily a role for everybody else, right? So, for example, some Jews are involved in Kiruv for Balei Tshuva. Some are involved in building regular so-called yeshivas and kollelim. Some are in communal rabbanus. I didn't mean to be that. I was not pejorative, I just meant that. Anyway, you know, others are congregational rabbis. Others, by their businesses and their professions, are also giving a message about the Yiddishkeit as a system of honesty and Kiddush Hashem. So everybody has a different mission, and certainly Or LaGoyim is one of Hashem's goals for us. But as they say, not every individual is expected to pursue every single goal. So we have different parts of the Jewish people that specialize, but each of us, at a minimum, should not make the Jewish message distorted and denigrated by our behavior. Yeah.
What is the concept of the Lamed Vav city camp?
Yeah, it's actually a Gemara. It's a Gemara in Sukkah. It's not like people think it's Kabbalistic, and of course it is, ultimately, but it is a Mepharish Gemara. The Gemara darshans on the Pasuk that God will do great miracles, Lemechakelo, to those who wait for him. For him. Lo is spelt Lamed Vav. So the Gemara itself says this is a remez to 36 tzaddikim, in whose merit the world stays alive at any given point. Now, why the number 36? We're not really given any reason at all, other than the drasha based on the pasuk. In a sense, 36 is double chai, and therefore the idea is they keep the physical world alive to enable us to earn olam haba. So they're a double source of life in both this world and the world to come. Now, the Gemara says virtually nothing else. That is only one in all of Shas. Now, those four words, Elu, Lamed Shel, is the only reference to it. So we know nothing about it from the Gemara. But in later stories, Midrashim and post-Midrashim, there are many, many embellishments about the 36 that they have to be hidden. Now, the Gemara doesn't say they have to be hidden, by the way, but it became hidden tzaddikim. Somebody once said about, a great Gadol said about the Vilna Gaon, that he was convinced the Vilna Gaon is one of the 36 hidden tzaddikim. So someone said back to him, what do you mean hidden? The Vilna Gaon is like the most famous rabbi in the world. How is he a hidden tzaddik? He says, with all of his fame, he is so much greater than people think, that he's actually a hidden tzaddik. It's like the tip, it's like the tiny tip of an iceberg. So, you know, so who knows? But in Hasidic tradition, Hasidic Shemaisim, and I'm not vouching for the truth of them, but in Hasidic Shemaisim, you always have the most unlikely person, like the janitor who's sweeping up in back of a movie theater. You know, it's always that type of thing, or the or whatever it is, or the homeless person, as Eliyahu HaNavi. You know, it's always, you know, who knows, right? You never know. But in Hasidic Shemaisim, they particularly made a point that it's always somebody who seems to be very, very, very distant from the image of the tzaddik. But there is a concept implicit in these stories, though, is an important yisod in our own Avodas Hashem, and that is the importance of hiddenness. The idea that the goodness and holiness of the world doesn't always come from public activity that people know about, but it's often the thing that is totally hidden. That's why Bedavka, the emphasis was on the hiddenness of the tzaddik. Because we tend to associate importance in things that are done publicly. And it's an interesting question, you know, that's why tznius. You know, tznius, people think, refers to how long a girl's dress is and everything else, and therefore men have nothing to do with tznius. But no, tznius is not so much about dressing, although that's a component of tznius. But tznius is about a certain attitude that our relationship to Hashem does not have to be a public, ostentatious one. It is a private, intimate one, and it doesn't have to be seen by everybody else. Now, that raises an interesting problem, and that is, it says when Rabbi Saul Salanter was a young man, he was deciding on what his derech was in life. At some point he said, he just wanted to be a nister. He wanted to be a private person that nobody would know about, kind of a secret tzaddik who served Hashem, which was the model, by the way, of his own Rebbe, Rav Zundel of Salant. If you know anything, Rabbi Zundel had a Rebbe, Rav Zundel of Salant, who was like a totally private. Nobody was a businessman. Like nobody knew what a big tzaddik he was, etc. Rabbi Saul Salanter wanted that model. But then he rethought it because he said the following. He says, in a generation where so many people don't follow the Torah, maybe we need to learn and daven and do mitzvahs publicly to inspire people. It's a very interesting idea that as important as it is to be modest and humble, sometimes you have to be willing to do mitzvahs in a way that people will see you doing mitzvahs, because that way they can learn from you. I heard a story once, really it's quite an amazing story, quite an upsetting story actually. I knew a man who, he was a Shomer Shabbos, but you know, he didn't learn or anything. You know, he didn't really learn Torah; it wasn't his thing. And he once told me that his father was a great, great Talmud Chacham, but his father was so humble he didn't even want his children to see him learn. So he only learned like when everybody was asleep, and as soon as a child would come in, he would take out a newspaper and read it. Now, you see the problem here. The father was acting out of great, great humility. He didn't want anyone to know that he ever picked up a sefer. But the result is, you know, your kid doesn't learn about picking up a sefer. So sometimes you got to be a little, you know, I'm going to learn. I'm going to dive in. I'm going to, you know, make a bracha, you know, with kavana. Sometimes a person feels embarrassed. He picks up such a bracha out loud. You know, it looks a little chinyokish, as we say, as the Yiddish expression goes, like a little fanatically frum. But you know, when you're raising a child, you know, it's good for a child to see that. A child learns, you know, you say brachas with enthusiasm and kavana. So you got to be, in effect, a shtickel nansanua when you need to influence people. So it's a difficult balance, the idea of modesty, reticence, and the idea of, you know, doing a mitzvah so that people will, particularly your family or your students, will learn from you. But that's the idea of the 36 tzaddikim. And I'll tell you another nice, sweet maisa. Somebody once said about another great person that he's one of the 36 tzaddikim. So somebody said, I don't believe that. He says, why? You don't know how great he is? He says, no, I do. But I can't believe there are 35 other people like him. He must be, you know, beyond the 36. There's such a thing even like that. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Are you giving me three choices or two choices? You say a nice idea, the truth,
nice idea, and then Torah or the truth. Like, how do you qualify the difference?
Well, the truth is, we really don't know. In other words, if we learn, you know, you learn something, I learn something, we come up with a thought, we come up with an idea, an explanation of Rashi or Tosfos or some thought in the Chumash. You know, is it absolute truth? We honestly don't know. You know, we're not Gedolim, we're not Nevi'im. We don't know. But the point to keep in mind is, in fact, somebody once said something to Rav Shach, and Rav Shach really liked it, a pshat. So he asked Rav Shach, he's like pressing his luck, he says, Rebbe, is this Amita Shel Torah? Is this the truth of Torah? So Rav Shach said, I can't say that it's absolute truth, but it sounds very good. And that's the best you can get, really. Now, the consolation prize is the following. The consolation prize is that the mitzvah of learning Torah, the mitzvah of thinking about Torah, doesn't require that you have to be right. Rather, it's the effort itself to come to the truth for which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you schar. So you're entitled to assume that you're right. If you don't have any proofs against you, you talk to Rabbeim, etc. So that's you're permitted to have that working assumption. Maybe you're fault, maybe you're not right. But the point basically is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's schar is on the yegiya, on the attempt to understand Torah. That's why in the Gemara, think about, in some ways, how much of the Gemara is discarded ideas. I mean, you go through a Shakla Vitaria. You have a teretz, you slug up the teretz, you have a hava mina, right? We're learning a lot of things that actually don't survive the final cut. That is, if you were to take a sugya of Gemara, and you were to say, what is the conclusion of this Gemara? You will find, depending on the sugya, that a lot of what you were going through, the Gemara itself was going through, turns out to be on the cutting floor, like a movie, you know, you're editing a movie. So you could ask yourself, you mean I've been wasting, you know, 2 weeks going over things that the Gemara says is shlugged up? The answer is you're not wasting. Going through the process is what is called Yegiyas HaTorah, Amelus HaTorah. That's why I have a kasha on a famous maisa with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. That's right, I think he was joking with the Maisa. What the Maisa was, he was giving a shir Shabbos afternoon, and it was time for Suda Shalichis. So he says, we have to eat Suda Shalichis. So his Talmidim asked him, Rebbe, it's brought down in the Shulchan Aruch that at least b'di'evet, you could be yotzei Suda Shalichis with words of Torah, b'di'evet. So if in the middle of a shir of so many people, so shouldn't you have been somech on the b'di'evet and say Devar Torah, and we don't have to eat? We don't have to stop a shir. Rav Chaim said, well, okay, let's say I would say Divrei Torah, Shabbos Mincha, and Sunday morning somebody refutes my Torah, proves it wrong. So Igloi Milsul Mafreya, retrospectively, we don't have Divrei Torah, we don't have Shalashuddis. So my Rebbetzin's gefilte fish is irrefutable. You cannot slug it up. Now, if Rav Chaim means to say that if you learn Torah and your conclusion is proven to be wrong, you don't have the mitzvah of Divrei Torah, that happens not to be true. You have the mitzvah of Divrei Torah even with your false starts. So I'm assuming it was meant as a joke. In other words, halachically, even if your Torah is shlugged up, you don't lose Shalashuddis. You're still were Makayim Suda Shalishis. So again, my short answer to your question is, you don't know, but on the other hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows you to proceed with what appears to you after talking to Talmidei Chachamim and Rebbeim, and you get reward for the effort. Yeah.
Furthermore, also, I see like there's a lot of ideas within that, like philosophical ideas, which have explanations to why certain things are asked. Again, how do you decipher that between that's definitely the right, the way you should live, compared to, you know, that's true?
Well, again, as I say, the pursuit of absolute truth is going to be elusive because we're human beings, and even the greatest gedolim can make mistakes, but we're not in a position to know what mistakes they made because we're so below them that we, you know, we're even worse, much worse off. However, there is a concept like this. There is a concept that the closer you are to Hashem, the more you will be able to intuit the truth, and you become close to Hashem by the process of learning, and by davening, and by mitzvos, and by maisim tovim, etc. So that's why we have this idea that gedolim have greater understanding than us, because even if they're not involved in so many things, the very fact that they learn for so many years with such devotion gives them a kesher. So in a smaller level, the more you learn, the more you daven, the more you do mitzvahs, the greater clarity you will have, and the greater probability, we'll call it probability, the greater probability you have that you're mechaving to the emes. Now, it's not going to reach 100%, but it will. The probabilities will go higher and higher as you become more davuk in Hashem, and we become davuk in Hashem, attached to Hashem, by our limud haTorah and by our masim tovim and by our mitzvahs. So that's really the best I can tell you. Now, this also highlights the importance of having a kesher to a Rebbe or a Talmud Chacham that knows you. He knows both Das Torah, but also knows Das Atzmacha. He has to know you too, right? You can't just go to a great person if the great person doesn't know who you are. And by being connected to somebody who's greater than we are, we're able to get an insight that out by ourselves we would not be able to get. But as I say, the best I can give you is you're just increasing the odds. You're not going to get 100%. That does not happen in this world. Yeah.
How important are the elections that are going on today that people actually, I mean, it seems that everyone's very excited about them and the going is saying that you should try to be okay to go
vote. You know, this is very complicated. Somebody asked me what I thought about Shas, and I said, by all means, you should finish it, you know. and I think that's the real answer. You know, the Shas on the shelf in back of you is a lot more important than the Shas that's in the ballot box. Personally, I do not regard elections as that important, although I have to say, I mean, there are kama gedolim who do regard it as important, and that's because Yerushalayim in particular does obviously have a special role in Am Yisrael. This is the holy city, this is the holiest place in the world, and there's presently a secular mayor, and the issue is that although the secular mayor is not an anti-religious person, but he's a non-religious person, and as a result, he's introduced many, many things that some people regard as a desecration of the city. For example, a gay parade. There are cultural events that are now held on Shabbos, which were never held on Shabbos before, so there's public desecration of Shabbos. The old railroad station has been converted into, it looks very nice, but it happens to be open on Shabbos doing improper things. So I'm not blaming him as a person, because after all, you know, he's a chiloni, and, you know, there are chilonim who want these things to go on. But the Gedolim have felt that we need to preserve Yerushalayim as more of a holier city. And even though we don't want to, nobody's talking about, you know, arresting Chilonim because they were Mechalel Shabbos. You know, what people do privately is their business between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we would like a government that has a greater sensitivity to the holiness of Yerushalayim. And the issue about the women in the wall is another example, the women that want to do their stuff by the Kaisel. So as a result, Gedolim were urging that we vote for both a religious mayor and also more members of the city council who would be Charedim or B'nai Torah. Right now there are 8 members, including Rabbi Pinder's son, who's the vice mayor. So they say, let's make the minyan. With more votes, they can get 10 members, and that would give them effectively a veto on different activities. Now, the emes is, there was almost no possibility, it's almost a certainty that the mayor, Barkat, will be reelected. You know, that's almost a certainty. Ad kedei kach, that Gimel wasn't even pushing for a mayor that much. They were just pushing for more representation on the city council, and that way they could block initiatives. They finally put up a candidate, Moshe Leon, but who knows, you know, Hashem can have all sorts of plans, but nobody expected him to win. So the Iker activity of Gimel was not for mayor. The Iker activity of Gimel was for city council. And there are 2 voters. You vote for mayor, you vote for the party of city council. What is very, very distressing, I don't want to be marach in this, but I just want to get it off my chest, is that as so often in Eretz Yisrael, B'nai Torah Charedim shoot themselves in the foot. And that is, they actually divide it. Rav Chaim Kanevsky and Rav Steinman are Gimel, which is Degel HaTorah, which is Rav Pinders' party and party of Rav Shach. But for reasons it's very hard for me to fathom, Rav Shmuel Orbach, who's also a Cheshen Begadol, created another party called B'nai Torah, which has a different mayoral candidate and different city council. So as a result, the Haredi bloc is effectively divided into two. Now, granted, I think Rav Orbach's party will have fewer, but still, in these types of elections, splitting a Haredi bloc by creating two parties which have really 99.99999% identical hashkafas is really a suicide mission. So I cannot figure out why this is happening. But the net result is going to be that probably, the changes that the Gedolim hoped for are not going to happen. Now, if you ask me how important it is, so this really depends. There's really a philosophical question here, and that is, how do we view ourselves as religious Jews living in the state of Israel? Some people take the position, not even a Turei Karta, they take the position, listen, the state is not religious, what they do is what they do. My focus is on, my community, my family, my learning, and what they do is what they do, and I should treat it like I would do in America. In America, I don't go around, demonstrating for this and this. So there are, I don't mean to trick out, there is a shita, and I think many Gedolim held this way, that don't get involved in politics, stay out of it, what they do is what they do. Our job is to create Kedusha within. Others felt, at least Yerushalayim is a different ballgame. Yerushalayim, we have an achrayas for the holiness of Yerushalayim. So my own netiya, it's not really relevant what I think, but my own netiya is more along the first line, actually. I don't think political activism is very helpful, and I think it creates chilul Hashem, and it creates nisyonos of money and power, and I think we should put our codes internally. But I have to say that apparently Rav Kinevsky and Rav Aaron Leib disagree with me, so I have to say that I'm probably wrong in that, because they did urge a certain amount of political activism. One thing I'm afraid of is this. I am afraid of the idea that these things go in cycles, and that is that if religious parties, as they gain more power, try to do things that the Chilonim don't like, then there's going to be a next election, which may have a whole wave. You have to be careful. You can't say, I have the power, so I'm going to do what I want, because these things move in cycles. And if you do what you want when you have the power, even if it's al pi Torah, then you're making yourself more vulnerable. They'll do what they want later. So you have to be careful. In a way, it's this involvement in politics is a dangerous thing. Yeah.
Did White Gimel specify your son as opposed to other cities like Kapot or Nebrach?
Well, B'nai Brak, there's no competition, so to speak. There are no, I know Chilonialism B'nai Brak. I don't know how we got there, but basically, you can count them, on one hand, etc. So B'nai Brak is not, no, so stop talking about something. They have Gimels in a few cities. Beit Shemesh, not every city is having an election, but Beit Shemesh, there are five cities. There's Ashdod. But Yerushalayim is the most important, because Yerushalayim has a symbolic meaning to the world. Yerushalayim is the Yer HaKodesh, the Mokom HaMikdash, the place of the Shekhinah. So one can understand that you don't want, if the Tzura of Yerushalayim becomes a more secular city, thank you, that has a ripple effect on the whole country. So this is more important than any other local election. Yeah.
Okay, so when someone becomes an Onen, how is he permitted to say Baruch Dayan MS?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Just to be sure people know the halacha, an onen is the status of a person, God forbid, after someone died, before burial. Once there's burial, he becomes an avel. He starts sitting shiva, and an avel has to do mitzvahs. An avel davens, an avel does brachos, etc. But an onen, from the time of death until the burial, which in Eretz Yisrael tends to be the same day, mamish, he's putter for mitzvahs. He's not even allowed to. He's not allowed to make a bracha. Right? He's not allowed to make a bracha at all. He's not allowed to wear tefillin. He's not allowed to daven, etc. So the question that was asked is, if an onen is not allowed to make brachos, there is one bracha that he does make. When he rips his garments, he makes the bracha, Baruch, with God's name, Baruch Dayan HaEmes. The short answer is this. The short answer is, in a way, the reason an onen is exempt from brachos and not allowed to make brachos is he shouldn't be distracted from his preoccupation with the mace. Memela, any bracha that is because of the mace itself is not a distraction. Lehepech, it's a focus. So Dayana Emes is a bracha about the loss. So that's the one bracha he does make, because that's not a distraction. That is focusing on the mace. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Really? Every charity? Every donation? Really?
The charity, they've got charity assistance, can reclaim the tax that you paid as income tax on that money.
One second. You don't get a deduction yourself? I mean, in America...
So, some people get a deduction, most people don't get a deduction. And so, if you give a charity £1 and you pay 20% income tax on that, the charity can claim that 20% back.
Okay, so in effect, they get the equivalent of what you would have taken as a deduction. Okay,
I understand. Can you use that as MISA?
That's very interesting, especially the way you explained it. I believe there's a good argument you could, because essentially, the money you have paid to the government in taxes on that charity, the government is essentially giving it to the charity. So it's almost as if the government is your shaliach. It's as if I'm giving the government $30 or whatever, £30 to give to the charity. I have to think about it, but to me, if it literally is a dollar for dollar transfer of the tax you paid the government gives to the charity, then essentially your taxes on that charity are earmarked to that charity. So I would think you could. I would think it could be an extra miser deduction. It's a very good point. Yeah.
Nowadays, first of all, where did the concept of Tanishpa arise? And nowadays, maybe more so in Eretz Israel, is there sort of a reduced status of Tanishpa? And also in regards to the U.S., maybe less than Eretz Israel, but still, is it still reduced?
Yeah. Tanishpa is a literally, it means a baby that was kidnapped, and the prototype would be the kid that was taken to Africa when he was 6 months old and never heard about God, never heard about Torah. So even though he doesn't believe in Hashem and doesn't believe in the Torah Sheval Peh, but, you know, it's not his fault, etc., Tinok Shenishba. Now, that concept is actually mentioned in the Gemara. It's from the seventh parak of Masechet Shabbos. But it's been vastly expanded in modern times. The first one who really expanded it extensively, well, actually was the Rambam, going back. The Rambam has a passage about the Karaim. The Karaim were a movement. They're not the Tztukim. They're later than the Tztukim. The Karaim were Jewish people. There's still Karaim around, who don't believe in Torah Shebal Peh. They only believe in Torah Shebichsav. And they obviously don't keep Shabbos properly, and they're also Kofrim in what we call Ikrei Emunah. But the Rambam writes, and there was a large Karaite population in Egypt, that the Karaim today, even in his time, Kal v'chomer today, since they were raised that way by their parents, they're not considered rebellious, they're not considered apikorsan, and there's a mitzvah to be makarev them, and to give them tzedakah, and to help them do tshuva, etc. So the Rambam brings in Tinuk Shenishba there. In the 19th century, we have the famous tshuva of the Orech Laner, that was Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's Rebbe, the Orech Laner, the Binyan Sion is the name of the Shela Uchuba, where the Binyan Sion writes that although a Mechalel Shabbos who touches wine that's not Mavushal, the wine is treif, like you know that halacha, but Reform Jews who were raised Reform and never really knew the truth of Torah have a din of Tinok Shenishba, and the wine that they touch is not forbidden. That psak is widely followed in the United States. In Eretz Yisrael, many people are machmir, so it's a bit more machmir. But Or Sameach itself, we try to have mavushal wine, which is not a problem, but occasionally we have guests with expensive tastes who bring non-mevushal wine, and the minhag of the yeshiva is actually to be somech on the tshuvos of the binyan tzion. But as I say, the Chazon Ish was machmer on this, etc. Now, the question becomes that who qualifies? Let's assume that we have this leniency for the tinok shenishba, right? They don't ask for the wine, they could get an aliyah, even though we're not bikaris, no, can't get any of those honors. Now, what is a tinok shenishba? Is every Reformed Jew a tinok shenishba? Now, again, keep in mind that even a Reformed Jew typically knows that Orthodox Jews do this and that, right? So first of all, you see the following. To be a tinok shenishba, you don't have to be a person who is unaware of what a life of Torah is. But even if you're aware, but if you were raised that that was crazy or stupid or not important, that's also tinok. Now, tinok shenishba is not only ignorance. It can also refer to knowing about something, but not knowing its significance. Ignorance of significance can be a tinok shenishba as much as ignorance of an underlying fact. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, okay, all right, so that's a Reformed Jew who never really learned about the importance of Torah, etc., especially when he's coming to learn more about Yiddishkeit, we'll call him a tinok shenishba. What about the kid who was raised from and left it? Right, he left it. He went through yeshiva. We have the kids who have been yeshiva. We have people who have smicha. You know, in fact, not so many today, but certainly in the 1950s, many Orthodox rabbis abandoned their Orthodox shuls because they thought Orthodoxy was dying and they could make more money in the conservative movement. Is that a tinok shenishba? So that's much murky. You know, somebody wrote a sefer recently. It's like 1,000 pages. Going through the definition of tinok shenishba, and he was claiming that we're much too makel in using tinok shenishba. Tinok shenishba does not apply to, you know, every off the derech person. Tinok shenishba applies to people who either were never from or they never understood what fromkeit was. On the other hand, there is another view that says that tinok shenishba might be expanded to really someone that was kind of a victim of their environment, that if they were in a very, very negative environment of Torah, in other words, negative in the sense that they were exposed to different friends and things that took them away, so in some sense, maybe we wouldn't call them tinok shenishba, but we would call them honest. We would call them almost forced by their circumstances. They bring a raya from the Chazon Ish, of all people. This is the only Chazon Ish that modern Orthodox people like to quote, because I mean, normally the Chazon Ish is very machmir, but here the Chazon Ish says a very, very interesting thing. The Chazon Ish says that all of the halachos in Chazal about apikorsim, that you reject them, that you throw them down a pit, that you don't care about them, only applied at a time when Hashem's hashgacha was open and revealed and apparent, like the Beis Hamikdash. But today, we live in a zman of hester panim, a time of divine concealment, where the path to Hashem is not self-evident. It's not obvious. So if a person doesn't follow it, we can't condemn them as a Rasha, because the whole world seems to be looking, going the other way. So the Chazon Ish says, b'zman hazeh, even the kaifer and the apikiris, so to speak, there's a mitzvah to be makariv them, the avosos ahava. Avosos ahava means with chains or ropes of love and not rejection. So the Chazon Ish seems to be on one level greatly expanding the tinok shenishba, not limited to the kid in Africa who never heard anything, and not even to the reformed person who thought Orthodoxy was crazy, but even the person who knew from Kaiden rejected it in a time of hester panim could be called a tinok shenishba. However, I do want to caution you that the Chazon Ish himself does not accept tinok shenishba as a heter for yayin. In other words, everything is context specific. Don't look at the Chazon Ish as saying all these things are mutter. The Chazon Ish actually says any mechallel Shabbos who touches wine, the wine is usher. Right? So the Chazon Ish is only talking about the, you know, being makarev and connecting to the person and not pushing him away. So I can tell you that there's actually a very big, big debate, and some people feel that we've been over-liberal in tinok shenishba. Some people are old, good old-fashioned Rishayim, and others feel that Fakert, the power of our negative environment is so great that even people who are from who rebel, we don't really characterize them as Rishayim in that case. Yeah.
Okay, so what's Torah view of the natural sciences? For example, the Slifkin controversies of the recent years have been quite strong, but on the other hand, I believe the Chofetz Chaim wrote a letter that says that even in the times of the Tanaim, if there's something that they posited based on science, they could have been wrong because it was based on science that they knew, and the Rambam, I believe, wrote a letter to one of his students telling him, yes, your learning is great in all areas except you need to improve your knowledge of physics. So it seems to be like there's a...
Well, you're asking really several questions here. In other words, the first question is, what is Chazal's attitude? What is our attitude? What is the Torah's attitude towards scientific study generally? The short answer is, we view it very, very positively. The Rambam writes, and the Rambam was, of course, a doctor and a master of many sciences of the time, that science is a mechanism of seeing the complexity and the elegance of God's universe. And it is a way that you come to love Hashem and revere Hashem by seeing the greatness of his creation. So there are at least two reasons why a Jew should try to be conversant with at least basic science. One reason is you need a certain amount, not extreme, but you need a certain amount of basic science to understand halacha properly. For example, you certainly need a basic knowledge of astronomy and trigonometry to determine the position of the sun and the moon for Kiddush HaChodesh and the like. And if you look at Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, there's a lot of arithmetical calculations and angles, measurements, trigonometry that the Rambam uses. In Sukkah, there was some geometry that you needed, etc. So on one level, you need it for Torah. And of course, let me add too, that in modern life, to understand halacha, you need to understand the science. How does a Rav Paskin, walking by a video camera is permitted on Shabbos or not, unless he understands how the video camera works. You know, is shutting off a computer erasing God's name? In other words, the posek has to know this, right? So on one level, some amount of scientific understanding is necessary to understand halacha. On the other level, it is spiritually useful because it gives a person a sense of the wonder of the universe, and you appreciate and love Hashem that way. So scientific study is something that is very, very useful, and it has a role. In fact, the Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying that for every measure of secular knowledge you don't have, your knowledge of Torah will be 10 times that as deficient. Again, some people like to say that's a forgery. Yeah, whatever, this is the minhag here. Whenever we come across an authoritative quote of a gadol that you cannot denigrate, so people say, well, he didn't say it was a forgery. No, the Gra said it, and the Gra wrote it, and this is the case. Again, it has to be secondary and tofel to Torah learning. But in all generations, great gadolim took time to learn these chachmas, whether it was the Rambam, whether it was the Rama. The Rama wrote a book on astronomy, etc. This was something that Gedolei Yisrael were always osek in. Now, they didn't want to institutionalize it necessarily in the yeshiva. They didn't want to automatically, you know, tell people to go to college. Those were issues. But Bitsina, privately, learning chachma was a good thing. Now, the other question you raised about Slifkin is really a difficult question, and that is, okay, if halacha is based on scientific assumptions, and modern science were to show that those scientific assumptions are not true, does that change the halacha? Does the halacha change? Can Chazal be wrong on science? And if they can be wrong on science, can they be wrong on the halachos that derive from that? See, there are a number of possibilities. You can either say, Chazal are never wrong, so if modern science says they're wrong, modern science is wrong, which means the science is as Torahic as the halacha. That's an extreme view. The other view is, well, they're wrong on the science, but the halacha is still right. And the other view is, if the halacha is based on the science and the science is wrong, the halacha gets changed, right? So there are three different ways of looking at it. Now, there are many examples. You know, one can write a whole sefer on this. In fact, there is a sefer on it. But the most famous example is killing a louse, on Shabbos. The Gemara says you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos. Why is that so? Because the issur of killing animals is only if they reproduce mizachar nekeva, and kinim do not reproduce by sexual reproduction. They reproduce by what we call spontaneous generation. The decaying of dirt and filth produces kinim. Therefore, you can kill them on Shabbos. Now, that's a very problematical halacha, because Pasteur, whenever it was, showed after the microscopes and the like, that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation, that everything comes from sexual reproduction. And in fact, even though lice are very tiny, but there is a Mr. and Mrs. Louse there that do get together and produce offspring. So the question becomes, now this is especially perplexing, because here the apparently erroneous science is not being machmir, it's being megal. See, it's one thing if it be machmir, we could say, okay, well, we're kind of stuck with it, although that's not a spiritually satisfying answer, but I could say, all right, if Chazal ossered something, even if the science isn't right, until Mashiach comes, I'm stuck. But this is a very qualitatively a very different thing. Here, the erroneous science, apparently erroneous, I don't want to say erroneous, the apparently erroneous science is maturing what would have been an Isser D'Oraisa. Is that Yitachin? So when this first came out in the, was it in the 1700s, when it was first determined scientifically that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. So there was a great posek called the Pachad Yitzchak. Now, this not to be confused, most of us, when we think of Pachad Yitzchak, we think of a modern work on Hashkafa by Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. Really a wonderful, wonderful work, but that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about an Italian Rav who wrote an encyclopedia of Halacha called the Pachad Yitzchak. And he actually concluded, in light of the fact that we now know that lice sexually reproduce, it is usher al pi kilakina b'shabbos. In other words, science changes, halacha changes. That's what he says, at least if it's going to be l'chumra. But most poskim don't say that. The halacha in the Shulchan Aruch still is, you can kill a louse on Shabbos. Now the Chazei Nish was masber this way. The Chazei Nish was masber that halacha is not based on objective reality. Halacha is based on visual perception of reality. Just as, for example, I'm allowed to eat invisible insects, right? I can open my mouth because the halacha says what you don't see doesn't exist. So too, since the sexual reproduction of lice is not visible by the naked eye, halachically, it is deemed to be spontaneous generation, regardless of the underlying facts. So Chazal were not necessarily ignorant of the facts. They could have known it. But their psak is based on visual perception. This is an important yisayis that applies in many areas. Tefillin is another example. You know, tefillin have to be square. Actually, they don't have to be square. They could be like stovepipe. They could be, they don't have to be a cube, rather, but they do have to be square. The length and the width have to be the same. Now, we have measuring instruments that can determine that something is a little off. In fact, it was interesting that a dentist who makes fillings, when you make fillings for teeth or implants, it has to be exact, right? You can't have a hundredth of an inch off. It's not going to work. So this dentist said, based on my instruments, I could show that my tefillin are not square. I can show when I use my instruments, I can see it's off. But the psak is, even if your instruments tell you that it's not an exact 90 degree angle, it's, you know, 89.98 degree angle or 90.1 or 0.01 angle, he says, if the average person looking at it, not even the expert, if the average person looking at it would see it as a square, halachically, that is acceptable. So the Chazon Ish's answer to that particular conflict is, you just look at visual reality, not actual reality. Rav Dessler has another mahalach, which is very problematic. Rav Dessler's mahalach is that even when Chazal had the wrong reason, Ruach HaKodesh derived them to the right conclusion, meaning Chazal paskins that harigas kinas mutter. They gave a reason which happens to be wrong. But their result is still emes, because Hashem's Ratzon speaks through the Chachamim. So we don't know the reason, Kaka. But mystically, Hashem will guide them to the right Hachra. That's kind of a mystical theory of Halacha. It's reminiscent of a famous story, another famous story involving Reb Chaim. You know, Reb Chaim of Brisk, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was known to this day for deep, deep analytical thinking. The whole deep, tremendously deep, deep thinker. But he hated the Paskin, although he was the Rav of Brisk, he absolutely hated the Paskin Halacha. He would not Paskin like it. He came out never Paskin any Shilas. He always had Dayanim, Rabbanim. He didn't want to Paskin. Part of it is, because Pesach Halacha, you can't always base it on your deep thinking. You have to look at precedent, what other Poskim say. And he felt that he couldn't just blindly follow other Poskim, but he didn't want, on the other hand, be independent either. So he didn't Paskin. So whenever he had a real difficult Shaila, he would send the Shaila to the Posek Hador. And the Posek Hador at that time, this is the end of the 19th century, was Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was really the gadol of the Paiskim in Russia. YU is named after him. That's why it's called Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Yitzchak Elchanan was, just like, you know, Chabad, every house has a picture of the Rebbe. Yitzchak Elchanan was actually kind of almost like a Misnagdash Rebbe. Every house in Russia had a picture of Yitzchak Elchanan on the wall. So when he would, this might be apocryphal, I don't know if it's true, but the story they tell is, he would ask Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, please give me a psak, do not give me any reasons whatsoever. Don't explain, just tell me, usser, mutter, yes or no. What's the pshat? So they say, if you were to give me a reason, a lumdus, I would probably disagree with you. I would see things differently, but I have total bitachon that Hashem will guide you to the right answer. I once heard this about a Litvish gadol who was learning Shilas Tshuvas of Sfardim, which has a different derech of learning. Although Rav Avadya is a bit of a bridge. But let's say it was someone, not Rav Avadya, someone had a... And he said, you know, I don't know how he got here. His conclusion is right, but I can't follow the steps. It was a different way of thinking, but somehow HaKadosh Baruch Hu guides him. So that's kind of Rav Dessler's theory. Okay, but the kids, all I can tell you is it's a big, big controversy. Here's the thing. Rabbi Slifkin's overall position is that scientific knowledge was not part of the Masorah Misinai, and Chazal were great and wise, but they were using the scientific knowledge of the time, and therefore, with respect to their science, they can be mistaken. He did not take a position on whether halacha changes. He actually said, you don't have to say halacha changes, but you can say the science was mistaken. The Gedolim, some Gedolim, didn't like that. They thought that was disrespectful. But all I can tell you is that his position is absolutely asserted by the Rambam and Rambam. Chavitz Chaim I'm not aware of. I would be a little surprised because the Chavitz Chaim tended never to say anything against Chazal. So what Rabbi Slifkin said is largely true. And if he got criticized for it, it was for some political reasons that they thought that in a generation where Chazal is so disparaged, it's not appropriate to bring up these ideas because they could be translated into disrespect for many, many things. But as I say, on the Etzem Davor, he is largely correct. But we have Rav Dessler's point that even if Chazal's science is not correct, Chazal's decision is the Ratzon Hashem in the world. And that's
so
a very
good. And what's the name of the book that discusses these halachas?
This is called Hishtanus HaTevoim LaHalacha, the changing of Teva. In other words, all of these things where there's a disconnect between nature and halacha. Sometimes we have that fallback because we just say nature change. You know, we say, well, in Chazal's time it was this, and then it changed. That's another backup teretz that we sometimes give. Yeah.
What's the source for not blowing out flames?
What is the source for not blowing out a candle with your breath? Yeah, it's not in the Gemara itself, but in different Sfarim it's brought down that a candle is symbolic of a human neshama. Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. The soul of a person is a human, is a candle lit by Hashem. So consequently it was thought that, and of course Hashem made us by breathing life into us. So when you're breathing out your life, your breath, and you're extinguishing the candle, it was said to be an ayin hara for death, and therefore one did not invite it. One did not invite it by doing something that's reminiscent of death, because it's death by expelling your breath and extinguishing the candle. Right? That's how that's how you die, basically. So, but as they say, it's not a halacha. It's not a halacha, but there is such a custom. There are many things that are customs that are not even. I'm using the English word customs because I wouldn't even automatically call them minhagim, but they were practices that many, many Jewish people had. Another example, if any of you have parents who are from Poland, I don't know if you ever experienced this, you walk around barefoot in the house. So it could be that, parents might tell you, don't walk around barefoot in the house. Well, what's wrong with that? Because when does a person walk barefoot? When they're sitting Shiva. Don't take off shoes. So there's this notion of don't do things that you do when you're sitting Shiva. Of course, other parents insist you take off your shoes in the house. Okay, but they're different things. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
The Rav has been machlokes between Misnokim and Hasidim regarding Simsum.
Is there what? There's a machlokes, yes. Yeah, well, this is a massively deep topic, and I'm not a tremendous expert in it. I will just give you the words, so at least you'll know the sentences of what is the big machlokas. It may seem very esoteric to us, but this was a major, major issue. It's still, to some degree, a major issue. Tzimtzum, which means contraction, is an idea that was developed by the Arizal. So it's pre-Hasidim, right? The Arizal talks about the simple question. If Hashem is Malay, Kol Aretz Kavodo, if God's essence is everywhere, then where's there room for me, for this, for God, for matter, for Gashmias? Hashem is everywhere. So the Ari says, Hashem Kav Yocho, his first act of creation was contraction into himself, making room, making a halal in which divine light could then come and create a radiance from Hashem. Right? That's Tzimtzum. Now, Tzimtzum is actually manifests itself on many levels. It is what enables Bechira. How am I able to make choices on my own without, if everything is from Hashem? So Hashem's Tzimtzum gives me autonomy, gives me Bechira. So the machlokas is this. The machlokas is Tzimtzum a reality, or is it only the appearance of a reality? And that is the Gra, the Nefesh HaChayim, what you call the Misnagdim, took the position that Tzimtzum was an actual withdrawal of divinity from space, which enables physicality to exist. Now, God controls the process. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could come in at any moment, but Hashem withdraws, and there's an actual realm that allows physicality to exist. Chassidus, and particularly the Baal HaTanya, took the position that that's impossible. He quoted from the Baal Shem Tov, that when the Pasuk says, Ein od milvado, there is nothing besides God. So most of us interpret that to mean there is no God other than God. He says, no, there is nothing other than God. Meaning, all physical reality can exist only because there is godliness within it. If there's no godliness within it, it's not shayach for something to exist. And therefore, Tzimtzum is the appearance. Hashem made a world where it looks like there is Tzimtzum, but there is not Tzimtzum. Without Hashem's essence permeating all creation, it could not exist at all. Now, you might think this is a theoretical, hair-splitting, Kabbalistic argument. It doesn't have so many repercussions. But you should know that the Vilna Gaon considered the Chabad position to be Avodah Zarah, because essentially you're telling me there's God is in the rock, and God is in the cup, and God is in the table. So everything's God. That's what philosophers call pantheism. Everything is God. Everything is Elokus. Avodah Zarah Mamish, right? So this was a big machlokas. Again, obviously one has to understand in depth much more than I'm able to tell you, much more than I understand myself. I will say at some point, Rev Dessler, who actually learned with many Chabad Hasidim, and Rev Dessler was a literature person, Rev Dessler wanted to reconcile the Nefesh HaChayim and the Baal HaTanya by saying, really, they're the same shita. You could for emperor, you could answer, you can reconcile. But he actually got a letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe saying, no, 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 these are two different shitas. They are different, and they're different, and don't try to make them the same when they're fundamentally different. Okay? So this is the idea. Now, again, I have to say that if you have a kasha on the Chabad position, that it creates pantheism, you have an equal kasha on the Lipshitz position, or at least a different kasha on the Lipshitz position, and that is, how could there be something in the universe where there's no God? Right? Can there be such a thing? Right? So either way, there's going to be a problem in how you define it. But that's essentially the machlokes. And that was when the Gaon put a cherem on Hasidim in the early years. That was one of the main points of contention, but not the only one. Not the only. I mean, a lot of it was behavioral. A lot of it was other issues which were peripheral. And even the Baal HaTanya rebuked. I mean, there were some Hasidim. Not his Talmidim, there were some Hasidim who were doing crazy things, like somersaulting during davening and other things. They felt that they have to kind of, their whole body has to serve Hashem in different ways, like the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, and the Vilna Gaon, you know, that was very, very repulsive and repugnant. So the Baal HaTanya actually sent these guys a letter and said, stop clowning around, you know, just, he ordered them to stop it, but whatever, but that was, philosophically, the issue was at Simson, yeah. Well, I mean, listen, the civilians are not walking around with guns because they're members of the NRA, whatever. You know. I mean, they're walking around because, either they're soldiers off duty or they live in moshavim that are dangerous, or they live in neighborhoods in which Arabs might sometimes engage in terrorist activity. So really, it's really for self-protection. I mean, Israel is not a country where people are gun hungry, you know, just for the fun of having weapons. People that have a gun usually need a gun. So I wouldn't say there's any particular halacha. You've got to be careful, you've got to be responsible. There is an issue about Shabbos. Are you allowed to carry a gun? Is, of course, muktzah on Shabbos. And using a gun involves a malacha. You're starting a flame, a fire, you know, etc. So whether you're allowed to carry a gun on Shabbos really depends on your situation. If you're not in a really dangerous situation, you should not carry a gun on Shabbos. But if there's a potential sakana, then you can, even without an Erev, because every case involves pikuach nefesh. That's similar to a doctor carrying a beeper or a cell phone. If he's only going to be contacted for life-threatening emergencies, he needs to have it, or Atsala, right? Atsala is the volunteer ambulance service, right? They have all sorts of beepers that they have on Shabbos. But other than that, as I say, you know, if you need to have a gun, it's considered pikuach nefesh. One interesting question, though, that I do want to raise with you, it's an interesting Hilchos Shabbos question. It's not so negeh where you have an Erev, but here's the question. Let's say I'm a doctor, and I have to carry a beeper because it's Shabbos, and potentially there's pikuach nefesh. Or I have to carry a gun. But here's the question. Good, I have to carry my gun, but what's the hetcher for me to go to shul with my gun? I'm carrying without an Erev. Now, you can't say that's necessary for pikuach nefesh because I could stay at home. In other words, you have this problem of, okay, I'm allowed to have it, I'm allowed to use it, I'm allowed to turn it on, but what's my hetcher to go walking around different places? Am I mechuyev to stay at home? And this is a question that arises in a lot of issues. Let's say, for example, a person has a cardiac condition and he has to take medicine. Right? He has to take medicine every 2 hours. So he has to have pills. Okay? But is he allowed, you know, why is he allowed to go to shul with the pills? Why don't we tell him to stay home? So that's an interesting question. So poskim debate this. Some poskim say, listen, you're allowed to take what you take, you're allowed to carry what you're allowed to have what you have, but you know, if you don't have to go out, you're not allowed to go out with it. Other poskim say that once pikuach nefesh says he's supposed to carry it, it becomes part of his clothing. It becomes equivalent to the clothing that he needs to have. And nimela, even without an Erev, he's allowed to carry it. It's an interesting idea. The same thing is true with passports. In the days when you needed, not passports so much, but in Europe you often needed, still need sometimes, identification papers. especially if you're Jewish, they would stop you, you know, identification papers. So am I allowed to carry my IDs on Shabbos, or do I say stay at home? So again, you have the same thing. Now, alternatively, there's another question. It doesn't work for a gun so much. But if you carry medicines or IDs, shelo kedarka, you put it in your shoe, or you put it under your hat, etc. So that's a drabanan. So for drabanan, we're making a gun. I wouldn't advise carrying a gun with a shinoi, because guns can go off in unexpected ways. So I would
what
be careful.
What about private gun ownership? Like in Texas, we all shoot guns, you know, on our ranges.
So, okay, so basically, again, what would halacha say about gun control? And like, again, halacha permits, even encourages, responsible ownership of weapons for protection. For recreational use, it all depends. A recreational hunting is not a proper Jewish activity. I'm not saying specifically usher. It might be usher if animals are suffering, tsar bali chayim. But the Nei Yehuda has a famous tshuva that even if you're not causing the animal pain, but to get pleasure by destroying animals is the midah of Esav and not the midah of Yaakov. And therefore, recreational hunting is not a proper thing. Now, an interesting question is, well, what if I like recreational hunting, but I don't kill animals? I like clay, you know, clay pigeons, they call them, I think. Right? So I just want to, well, it could be that's okay. The problem basically is that I think it puts you with the wrong group of people. I think it puts you with a group of people who are hunters and the like, and I think you get influenced by people. So I think in that sense, it's not such a great activity. But technically, if you're shooting and you're just shooting inanimate things, there would be no isser in that. Yeah. Well, a beard was the traditional way that Jews were, because, of course, in the ancient world, that was very common in all of the Middle East societies. Shaving is a relatively modern thing, but the Torah does not prohibit shaving. The Torah prohibits two things. So it prohibits cutting your payas with a razor, and the Torah prohibits using a razor on five corners of the beard. Now, technically, the corner, we're not exactly sure, that's the short article, we're not 100% sure, but the corners are the angles, like the points of the jaw, here, 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 and here. So technically, between the bone of the sideburn and the lower jaw, you are allowed. That's the goatee, right, the goatee of the German Rabbanim, you're permitted. But the isser is only with the razor, not with scissors. Scissors is mutter. Razor is usser, and then you get into a machlokes. How do you classify an electric shaver? Again, I don't want to give you a psak on that, but basically the question becomes, a single blade razor is a very, very close cut. Scissors, by definition, is not that close, because you have the blade of the scissor acts as a block, as a shield. The question is, on one hand, electric shavers do have a shield. On the other hand, they have a lift and cut mechanism, many of them, right? So you can ask your local rabbi about it. I just want to teach you the basic. The basic halacha is single blade razor, absolutely usser. Scissors, absolutely mutter. Machlokes, haposkim, how to classify various electric shavers. So shaving is not usser at all, as long as you do it in a way that does not involve the equivalent of a single blade razor, which is the prototype. Now, having said that, in Chassidus and in Kabbalah, not in Halacha, there was a strong, strong idea of not shaving based on mystical ideas that the beard is somehow a conduit of understanding, of bina, that comes into a person through the beard. And that's why among Chassidim, based on the Arizal, there was a very, very strong idea of not shaving. And among Litvish Gedolim, like the Chazon Ish, he also said that for a Ben Torah to shave was considered to be chukos hagoyim and was not a proper behavior. However, the Chazon Ish, as a Litvish Gedolim, was really a das yachid, because it was very, very common in Mir and in Slobodka for single boys to shave. It's only after they got married they had a beard, and even after they got married, it was like Rosh Hashivas had beards. It was not always as common as we assume. Among Chassidim, it was extremely common. Now, having said that, the idea of not shaving at all is really a Hasidisha or Kabbalistic idea, I do want to point out that there were great Mekubalim who actually did shave. One of the great Mekubalim was Rav Menachem Azaria Mifano. Mifano is in Italy. He's called the Rama Mifano. Reish Mem Ayin. Rama Mifano. And he was a Talmud of the Arizal. And he wrote some Sifrei Kabbalah that are very, very important Sifrei Kabbalah. And we have a picture of him. And in some of the pictures, it says he didn't have a beard. We see he didn't have a beard. Some changed the picture to put on a beard, as it were. But it seems that the Italian Mekubalim did have a Messiah that, I think they have a cheshbon that after the Chorban, only Mekubal figures this out, but after the Chorban, the problem of shaving no longer exists. I mean, the halachic issue still exists, but the generals are saying didn't exist, and they connected it to the Chorban and the Shechina and Galus and the like. But as they say, that was a Das Yochid. I think the Ramchal may also perhaps didn't have a beard. But again, the Ramchal was also an Italian Kabbalist, so that was the Shita in Italy, as it were. Yeah.
I was wondering if the Rook would tell us about Lilith.
Well, I never met her, you know. according to... so here's the thing. Lilith is not mentioned in the Gemara, and it's not mentioned in the Medrash Rabbah or the Medrash Tanchuma that are the very, very authoritative Midrashim. It is mentioned in a Midrashic collection called Yalkut Ruveni. Now, Yalkut Ruveni is very different than Yalkut Shimoni. Yalkut Shimoni is also a very authoritative Midrash. Yalkut Ruveni is less accepted as an authentic source of lost Midrashim. But in the Yalkut Ruveni, it does mention the idea that Lilith was like a parallel creation, a Techava, kind of an evil woman. And for the 130 years that Adam HaRishon was Poresh, after Kayin killed Hevel, he separated from his wife for 130 years. That's why he had Shais 130 years later, but he was connected with Lilith and the like. Now, in all probability, I would suggest the following. I'm not a bucky in this. I would suggest that there's an inner meaning to these to this medrash, which is not meant to be taken literally, and that is Lilith does not represent an actual female figure, but it probably represents improper sexual thoughts that he had for the 130 years. Others, Lilith is like the personification of sexuality that is not linked to the context of marriage. So Lilith is probably intended to communicate a certain dark idea of improper sexuality more than an actual thing. Okay, and this is the way Midrashim talk, that they concretize things which are really ideas, and that would be the relevance to us, so that would be a relevant idea for us to keep in mind about pornography and all these other things, that they do destroy the soul in a significant way. Yeah.
With regards to the group of Natura Carta, you met with the president of Iran.
Yeah. I would not call them rotfim, because again, a rodef has to be somebody who has a gun to your head. You can't really kill a person. I mean, after all, keep in mind, Rabin was assassinated with the argument that he was adopting policies that would, you know what I'm saying, you can't use future things to make rodef. Now, I do think, to be charitable to them, they were severely misguided, and perhaps shaitim. Right, that's to be charitable. To be less charitable, there would be Rishoyim. I think it's a very, very evil thing to meet with enemies of the Jewish people and badmouth your fellow Jews and say bad things about them. That's not a good thing. The Satmar Rebbe, who was as anti-Zionist as anybody could be, it is said that during the Six-Day War, he was praying that Jewish soldiers would not get hurt. Even though he was against the State of Israel, he called for its dismantlement, but he said that if Jewish lives are in danger, you pray for them. Okay, so it really doesn't make sense, because basically it just gives Iran legitimacy to destroy a Jewish country. Because they say, hey, even the Jews told me I should dismantle it. And then when it gets into Holocaust denial, then it becomes theater of the absurd. I mean, people come from Yerushalayim and whose grandparents probably got killed in the Holocaust, and they hear this guy talk about it never really happened. You know, what's that about? It's very, very... So I'll call them shaitim in that way. I want to judge them with kafsichus.